Welcome to Software Gone Wild, a podcast describing, among other things, production-grade programmable network products. I'm Ivan Pepelnyak, blogging at ipspace.net, and my today's guest is Matt Stone, a really good friend of the show, occasional co-host, and most importantly, CTO at Stratusplex, a cloud service provider and an early adopter of Cumulus Linux. So now you know what the topic of today's podcast will be. How are you, Matt?
I'm doing really good. I'm doing really good.
Nice to hear that. No problems with Cumulus?
Not today. To be honest, we actually haven't had any problems with Cumulus. But I say that not today because we've had plenty of other problems. It's a normal Monday.
Of course. So, how did you become involved with Cumulus? Why did you decide to test it?
So this is actually kind of funny. The first time I ever heard the word Cumulus, in reference obviously to the product, was from you at the Tech Field Day or the Network Field Day event, whenever you were basically talking about how you would never run it.
You mean that one where they got really upset with me afterwards?
Yeah, that one. So that was actually the first time I'd ever heard of Cumulus. And so I was in the process of evaluating Topper Rack solutions when you said that. And so...
So you had to try it.
Exactly. I was like, well, if it's that terrible, then I should go try and find out what it's about, right? No, I kind of added it in, or not really added it in, but kind of found out what they were about through your thoughts on it. And then as I started progressing down the path of choosing a solution, so I guess if I step back a little bit, we kind of, in the end, it came down between Cisco, Arista, and Cumulus. And then Cisco quickly became not a viable option for us because it didn't have a lot of programmatic capabilities. We couldn't really create any scripts where we could make programmatic calls to it. We could do screen scraping all day, but we didn't want to do it that way. And so basically it boiled down to Arista and Cumulus.
And on the Cisco side, that would be Nexus product line? Or...
Correct. Yeah, we were looking actually at the 3Ks. So it would have been almost, identical hardware for the three products. It was, it's all Trident-based. So it was really, all the hardware was the same. So it was really an OS competition, to be honest. So 1PK wasn't really out of vaporware at that point. It was still in kind of closed beta. We didn't really have any access to that. And so it was one of those deals where it was like, okay, we could go Cisco and screen scrape. We could go Arista and pay a fortune for it and have a Python library. Or we could go with Cumulus and not pay that much for it and still have programmatic access. And so that's what it boiled down to. So... In the end, we decided on a financial perspective to go with Cumulus, and we haven't looked back since. So,
for people who are not familiar with Cumulus, it's a software-only solution that sits on third-party switches.
Correct. Yep. So it is Cumulus in and of itself is a Debian-based Linux distribution that has some extra secret sauce in there to get a lot of the information that's stored in the kernel level. So like your MAC entries, your ARP table, your routing table, etc. They basically transpose that directly into the hardware. So if there's a route inside of the Linux kernel routing table, that gets pushed into the Broadcom Trident product and switched at hardware level. That's effectively what they're doing as far as how the actual hardware interaction works. Everything else above that is just Linux to you.
Oh, this sounds almost like iOS XE.
I guess. Yes, except for it doesn't come with any kind of CLI beyond Bash. So like... iOS XE, you're right, that's exactly how it works, except for that you get iOS-style syntax that you get dropped into when you console into it, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the only difference is you get dropped into Bash with Linux on the Cumulus gear versus just like a familiar iOS-style interface with the Cisco gear. And so that's both intimidating, but also where it has its value. So.
Yeah, and in iOS XE, you have this single monolithic process, which is effectively iOS running on top of Linux, whereas here you have different daemons for different thingies, right?
For sure, yeah. I mean, it's if we go and, if we talk about just strictly what Cumulus is, like it's obviously it's Debian-based, and then you've got SwitchD, which is that process I was describing earlier that is responsible for taking in all of the information from the kernel level and putting it into the Broadcom level.
The magic sauce.
That's right. Yeah, so SwitchD is responsible for that kind of communication between the Broadcom chip and the OS. And then they've rewritten some packages, like Bridge Control is slightly tweaked to kind of handle some of the nuances with Broadcom and stuff like that. For instance, like setting the speed of your NIC instead of like having to go do it in some kind of funky Broadcom specific way, you can do it still through the ETSI network interfaces file, stuff like that. So everything that Cumulus has built surrounds interacting with the Broadcom chip, at least to date, and then also kind of enhancing and streamlining how you would traditionally configure these things on Linux. And I'll get into that a little bit later. But so you've got Debian, and then you've got SwitchD, and then beyond that, it's kind of open-ended. Like, you're basically just dropped into a Debian box like you would any other server. It's just you have 48 ports of 10 gig hanging off of it.
And all the other software that you would need, like routing protocols, I don't know, IPv6 RA stuff, and so on and so on. It's all based on open source Linux packages.
Absolutely right. So, like, if you want to say run like OSPF v3, then you would enable that process however you want to. So, if you wrote your own custom OSPF instance, go at it for sure. Whatever you want to do. But the more sensible thing to do is use one of the more widely supported packages, like Quagga, which is what they do. They leverage an entire Quagga stack, which, for those of you who aren't familiar with that, that's just an open source bundling of kind of traditional routing protocols. So it has RIP, RIPNG, OSPF, OSPF v3, and BGP. And so, and Quagga can also handle some IPv6 stuff like RAs and stuff like that that you can configure through. And actually, Quagga has a very Cisco style syntax where you can configure IP addresses and stuff like that for interfaces. I actually don't like that fact. I actually wish that it was configurable like any other Linux daemon. I wish it wasn't trying to be more Cisco-esque, I guess, because I feel like that kind of hinders it in some ways. But you have the option. For instance, there's also a project within Cumulus to also get Bird, which is another BGP daemon working on Cumulus and stuff like that. So you're kind of only limited by what's available, really.
Okay, so to defend Quagga a little bit, you know, a traditional way that Linux daemons were written was, okay, if you change configuration, you'll either restart the daemon, which means shutting it down and starting from scratch, or you reload the daemon, which would reread the new configuration, but would usually lose the existing state. So both options are clearly totally unacceptable if you're running OSPF or BGP.
Correct. Correct. And I mean, like, so the reload function, for instance, in initd, that's totally at the discretion of the application developer, right? So, like, the reload level functions could be rewritten in such a way where it keeps the state. It's just most applications are not done to do that. Like, for instance, Apache will do that in some cases. And a lot of times that's just because there's other actual daemons that are handling the communication for the in host. But it's kind of up to the application developer's discretion on how they want to write that. I get what you're saying, and you're right. And so in most cases, that state is lost. However, there are ways to work around that. And it's not really even a workaround. It's just how you architect the thing. I don't like that Cumulus has done some stuff to abstract this that I really appreciate. Like, a lot of times, if you want to, from a Quagga perspective, let's say you're just running it on raw Debian, you've got to drop into like VTYSH, which is basically opens up this like loopback shell. So it's effectively consoling into Quagga from the shell, from Bash. Mm-hmm. And you'd get dropped. I'm assuming you worked with it. But for those of you who aren't familiar with it, you got to drop into this shell, which basically mimics like a Cisco-style syntax, which actually is helpful in some cases when you've got somebody who isn't familiar with how you interact with the Linux machine. You can be like, hey, type this, and then it'll be somewhat familiar for you. But for me, I'm kind of an all-or-nothing kind of guy. I wish almost that it had gone the other way, because in some ways that limits me on how I can interact with it. So Cumulus is working through some of that and kind of trying to make some hooks at the like being able to pipe certain information into Quagga so you can have it interact or have it do certain things while it's live. But we just aren't there yet, and that's just a function of where we're at with the software. So as that progresses, it'll get easier and easier to do. But for me, I don't prefer it being more Cisco-esque, and it's not because I'm trying to bash on Cisco. I just would prefer it to be, if I'm going to invest fully in this ecosystem of, you know, I'm using Linux as my top rack platform, I would at least prefer it to be all configured in a similar way. And so if I take a step back in what I said earlier, Qemus has actually done a lot of work to abstract that to where you can actually run commands from your shell. And so you can write I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but it's like CL-OSPF-something. And you can actually get like the neighbor state and stuff like that live from the shell. So you don't actually have to drop into VTYSH, which is really cool because that is more familiar for networking engineers, but then also it's very similar to how other Linux packages work. Like for instance, IP route 2, where you can say, you know, IP show ETH 0 or whatever.
You try to be diplomatic. I can sense that. And I don't have to be. effectively, if you have Quagga on Linux, you're back to screen scraping.
Yeah, well, you are, except for it. It depends on what you're trying to configure, right? So if you're just trying to configure VLANs or...
Because you're not touching Quagga as such.
Right, right. And so that kind of goes back to where I was talking about, where if we can build hooks into Quagga at the process level, then we go back to that programmatic access. And so you're right. Like there is a little bit of that, except for that I can still template quagga.config and just change quagga.config and then reload the process.
And lose all OSPF and BGP adjacencies while doing that.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say. I'm not 100% sure, because that's not how we interact with Quagga on the device. I'm not really sure what the effect of a reload would be. And maybe you've run Quagga enough to know whether or not reloading it, does it actually bounce the OSPF service, or is it actually keeping the state?
Well, I have my suspicions.
I will actually perform that in our lab and see what happens.
Okay, and let me know, and we'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah, for sure, because I would be interested to know, because you can edit that Quagga config, reload it, and if that was the case, and let's assume for a second that it does keep the OSPF adjacencies up, etc.
Then we're good.
Yeah, you could template that file all day, and you still can have programmatic access over that, because you can still do stuff with that at the file system level that you can't do on, say, like a Cisco box or a Juniper box.
Well, you can do the same thing. You do config replace.
And I guess at the same time, though, you're still losing all of the programmatic access to other things like counters and IP address state and routing table state and stuff like that. And that's kind of the next progression of that. So like anything at the kernel level that you can call. So for instance, like the ioctl calls or the netlink calls to get information about certain state about the IP table or to configure an interface in a certain way, you have full access to all of that on a Qemus box. So if you make an ioctl call or a netlink call to configure an interface in a specific way, the kernel honors that and then switchd transposes that onto the actual hardware. And so anything that you can do from that perspective is fair game.
Okay, so to be fair to Qemus, what I was saying about screen scraping applies only to Quagga and whatever information is in Quagga, like OSPF adjacencies or BGP adjacencies.
Correct.
The moment it gets
into... Which is arguably really valuable information.
Well, of course. But the moment you get below that, the moment you are at the level of the IP routing table or below, like the forwarding table or MAC address entries or ARP entries or interface parameters, because they are configured with different tools, you can interact with those tools directly and extract information from the Linux kernel, for example.
For sure. And all of those tools, including Quagga, are all leveraging the same things, right? So like IP route 2. And I know I'm not telling you any new information, but like IP route 2 is just making netlink calls to display and configure information how you see fit. And so the same thing with Quagga, it's just compiling some information from user space applications like OSPF or BGP. It's distilling that into a best route or whatever, and then pushing that into the Linux routing table. And it's the way it does that is through netlink. And so you have access to all of that too, which in turn means you have access to, if you wanted to, create, you know, Pepinac protocol that routes things in specific ways. And so anything you introduce into the routing table gets pushed into hardware, which is actually kind of cool.
So on one hand, you have whatever that interacts with Linux kernel. And Netlink is like an API for the Linux kernel, right?
That's exactly right. It's an API into the kernel. However, when people think API, they think REST now because that's so popular.
Oh, come on. people who read the trade magazines and listen to podcasts think REST.
Exactly. Well,
there
that's
are other people who have seen APIs in their life.
And actually used them.
Yeah.
And so it's not like it's fairly well documented in code. And so that's
we don't need documentation. The code is obvious.
Right.
Oh, good.
And it's all C. So it's not like just to say that it's an API. It's a little bit. It is an API, but it's not just your average Joe is going to go write net link calls, if that makes sense.
Hopefully.
Well, yeah. Oh, I guess they can, but good luck. I don't want to run on that switch.
So to sort of get out of this nerdy deep dive, so you decided to go with Cumulus, and you need some switches, some hardware to put Cumulus on. So what did you choose?
That was actually really easy because there's only like a handful, and they're all kind of the same. So you've got like Penguin Computing or EdgeCore, which is an Acton company, and then there's another one, Quanta. And so those are kind of all of the kind of, I guess, the big white box names, if you will. But they're all basically the same, right? So you pretty much just pick one that has the best price. That's kind of how we landed at it. We ended up with EdgeCore, and that was kind of a good combination of some of the documented metrics versus price. And so that's kind of how we chose EdgeCore. And at that point, and so to give you a kind of, I guess, kind of a little bit of a life cycle of what it's like to get a white box switch, because you're not buying this from Cumulus, right? You go out and you buy a switch just like you would buy a server from, say, Dell or IBM, and they send you a box, and then you're responsible for putting an OS on it, right? So that's effectively what the Cumulus model is as well. You get a box that has a piece of software on it called Oni, which is its only purpose in life is to image that box with whatever OS you want to run on it.
So it's like Pixie Boot.
Correct. Yeah. It is Pixie Boot on steroids, right? So it can do a lot of stuff over HTTP or FTP, however you want to define that. And it's got a little cadence by which it follows for how it's going to search for a valid image. And the thought process there is kind of how you provision bare metal. Like, how do you go from bare metal to a base config? And Oni can take care of that process for you. And so you could conceivably say, okay, I've got a big room full of, you know, 1,000 switches, and they all boot up and then find a web server, download the image, and then reboot back into that image. Oni handles that whole process. And most of the switches that you're buying now come with Oni on it, most of the white box switches. And actually, Oni is a project that was started by Cumulus. It's got a few other developers on it now, but it was started and kind of championed by Cumulus to enable kind of their thought process on how they wanted to see switches progress. And there's been other people who have leveraged that as well. So like if you look at Big Switch and what they're doing with their, I forget what it's called, but the Switch OS for Big Switch that is effectively just an OpenFlow agent, they can use Oni to get that image onto a switch.
Well, that's a no-brainer.
Right, and that's actually one of the compelling reasons, one of the things I like about white box in general. So if you just remove Cumulus from the conversation for a second, like white box going forward, I think is kind of the ultimate, I don't want to say safe play, but that's kind of the only really way to verbalize it, is it's the ultimate safe play. So like, let's say that you have a need today that's met with X software, and then in 5 years, you don't really need any more bandwidth, but you do need a different functionality that can still be leveraged through Broadcom. So let's say today, Cumulus meets my need, and in 5 years, OpenFlow or a specific controller in OpenFlow meets my need. I mean, you could conceivably image all of our switches, or in chunks, image all of our switches into an OpenFlow agent. And so I'm not saying that's a sensible route. I'm just saying it's possible. And so if ideally for me, where I would love to see the networking industry go is more towards a software style. And I don't mean that from like a software defined whatever. I mean a focus on creating a solid network operating system that can fit on a white box switch, and then you enable whatever features you want, you enable whatever functionality you want on top of that. The same way, and almost the same way that Big Switch has done it. Like I would love to see other companies follow that same cadence. Plexi, for instance, comes to mind. Like I would love for them to have a white box offering that leverages some of the stuff they're doing through Affinities, where you could conceivably purchase. I mean, obviously you don't get access to their kind of proprietary kind of optical stuff that they're doing, but you could still leverage the Affinities and stuff. And so that would be a cool thing if we could see, kind of some of these smaller companies that are trying to compete against like the Ciscos and stuff to start releasing their stuff on white box. That's where I would really love to see the industry start heading.
Yeah, Plexi could theoretically do that if you build a leaf and spine fabric or...
Yeah, and so like one of the biggest barriers from my perspective to Plexi to entry is that their concept of what a data center network looks like is so different than any other concept. And not only that, but it doesn't really typically fit any kind of existing cabling plants. And so if they were able to leverage the assets that Whitebox brings to the table, then that's an obvious like step into the door. Like what is your path to go from, you know, a greenfield or even an existing deployment to X, Y, or Z, where X is Plexi, Y is Cumulus, or Z is Big Switch? I mean, you can see, I guess you can kind of see the value in, hey, this same hardware can leverage all of these different operating systems on top of it. You're not tied to a specific vendor.
Yeah, well, Plexi could actually do that with any white box switch. You know, like they have this weird cross-connect box that emulates their ring within a box, and you connect every switch to that box with a couple of uplink cables.
Aren't those uplink cables still, though, the... And that we're kind of going down a rabbit trail now, but aren't those uplink cables still like the MTP connectors with the like?
It's some weird connector, but behind it, it's actually 4x40 gig, which is 16 lanes of 10 gig.
Right. And you could technically still do that through a white box solution, but you still have to have that proprietary, not necessarily proprietary, but you still have to have that additional optical kind of interface hanging off of it somewhere.
Yeah, but that replaces your spine layer.
For sure. For sure.
So if you want to go down that route, well, of course, you have to throw out the spine layer, or hopefully you bought the spine layer that can be reused as top of rack switch. You insert that magic sauce in the middle. You put Plexi software on the white box switches, and bam, you have a Plexi ring.
Mm-hmm. So
in some other universe.
Yeah, you could conceivably do that. And so that's when I think about like where Cumulus is headed and where white box in general is headed, like I think of it less as like, hey, you should go deploy Cumulus in your enterprise. And I think of it more as the ultimate development platform. And so for these networking companies, like for instance, Pluribus comes to mind, where they went and built out X, Y, and Z, and they had to, you know, build their operating system, which I think they leveraged some open source stuff there. They're using Quagga, like a lot of the same stuff. Well, they could have conceivably just leveraged Cumulus and then built their proprietary or their IP on top of Cumulus. And so that's honestly where I see the sweet spot for Cumulus. Obviously, Cumulus is going to get a lot of play in places like Facebook, places like Google, not necessarily them, but those kind of scale places where they have a lot of in-house resources where they can develop and create things on the switches themselves, and they need that kind of access. But for the average data center and the average Joe who's going to be managing that, I think Cumulus is a really compelling product and a really compelling platform by which other companies can build and manage and create kind of a product on top of Cumulus.
So you think it will become like a development platform?
I think it could be. I think it's very compelling as that. I don't even know if I've had a lot of conversations with Cumulus, but never necessarily about this. And so I don't even know if that's on their map. But from my perspective, yeah, I mean, you could conceivably see a company coming into the field that says, okay, I'm going to target enterprise networks. Like let's pretend that there's an enterprise class like PoE switch on the Cumulus support list. They're going to say, I'm going to build this cloudy based, really easy to use interface by which traditional IT shops can manage their network. And I'm going to use Cumulus because I don't really have a lot of development expertise at necessarily like the Broadcom level. So I don't necessarily want to go build a switch, but I can leverage Cumulus and then build these abstractions on top of it and have Cumulus be my underlying platform by which all of this runs on. I mean, I think it's really compelling at that.
Well, this works as long as your innovation is on the control plane.
Correct.
The moment you have to optimize the data plane, like what Arista is doing with their latency analyzer and all the other crazy stuff that they're doing.
Well, to a degree, right? So as far as you're right, from like trying to optimize TCAM space, you're not going to be doing that on a Cumulus box. If you've got engineers that are wanting to do that, then by all means go become a partner with Broadcom and get access to their SDK and go at it. But you still have the option to manipulate the data plane from what routes get forwarded where.
Yeah, but it's above the routing table.
You can't
squeeze the last 20% out of the Broadcom chipset.
Correct. But I mean, how many people need that?
Well, talk to Arista, they'll tell you that everyone needs latency analyzer. Yeah, they may not know they need it, but
I'm not on Wall Street, and most people aren't either. And so, especially when you start talking about enterprise class stuff, and I will give you that point that most of the innovation here would come from the control plane. However, that doesn't mean that the data plane is completely out of the picture, because you can still manipulate it in certain ways, just like we were talking about earlier. I mean, all Quagga's doing is sitting above the routing table and introducing routes to it, right? And nobody would say, you know, SPF isn't needed. But at the same time, there's still plenty of, and you can kind of, you can go far and wide with this, right? But one of the people that I know that that does some Cumulus stuff is from Orion VM, and he actually spoke with me at LinuxCon. We actually both gave a little presentation for Cumulus at LinuxCon. And the CEO of Orion VM was talking about one of their pet projects was to effectively fit the entire BGP table, or the efficiency of the entire BGP table, into a Cumulus switch. And so what they were doing was ingesting all of the routes, because they've got plenty of memory to work with, but they don't necessarily have plenty of TCAM space. So it's just like a Nexus 3K,
doing
right?
Virtual
so it's
aggregation.
Correct. I mean, and so, but it's, and that's not new. There's other people that have done that before. I'm just saying they were able to write their own process that ingested that table, distilled it down to what they needed, and then pushed it into the TCAM, which is actually pretty cool.
Well, I think you could even do that on Quagga itself, because Quagga by default doesn't transfer the BGP routes into IP routing table.
Well, there you go. That's something I didn't know.
Well, or you can turn it on and off. I know I had Quagga running on my Linux box, and the BGP routes didn't appear in the IP routing table. So You could turn on the filter right there.
Yeah. And so that's true. But at the same time, that stuff that you're leveraging on top of, like that stuff you can't do in other devices, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah,
and
sure.
So
totally understand.
As like a, even from like a service provider perspective, as like an edge device that has a lot of throughput, because any kind of service provider device that has a lot of throughput, you're automatically talking about huge amounts of money. And so if you can leverage a white box solution that has effectively the same function from a routing perspective, but is much cheaper, I'm all for it.
Well, you see, when you start talking about a service provider space, it depends on what the use case is. Obviously, for you, you only need connectivity.
Mm-hmm.
And then whatever quality of service or metering or contract enforcement you do it in the hypervisor.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're a cloud provider. If you're a service provider, you have to do that on the edge switch, which is why the service provider switches are so expensive.
Right. And to be clear, I'm not advocating for this to be like the actual peering device or the provider edge. I'm assuming another layer behind that. So this would kind of be aggregating those devices. So like, for instance, in a GPON style network, this wouldn't actually be aggregating any of the GPON network. You would do your metering and your classifications and stuff like that on the access level, which is at the GPON level. And then you could conceivably use something like Cumulus to aggregate all of that up and even run BGP.
Yeah, and you can do that today with reasonably priced switches, as long as you don't want to have any extra features like MPLS or quality of service or shaping. Shaping is really hard.
Or a amount of TKM space to fit the internet table into.
Oh, yeah. You definitely don't want to do that. In residential service provider networks, you don't need the full BGP table anyway. You only need the full BGP table if you have customers that take the full BGP feed from you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in which case the ability to have that thing in the BGP table but not in the routing table would come really handy.
For sure.
And it's available now on iOS, and it's been available on Junos forever. So, just saying.
Right. That's a huge rabbit hole, too, because Cumulus is not even in any way, shape, or form geared towards service provider stuff. But
okay, let's get back
on. If you take a step back and you look at kind of a Cumulus box versus any other vendor box at the data center level, you for the most part got feature parity there. I couldn't say that a few months ago because of MLAG, but Cumulus begrudgingly added MLAG. I actually respect their engineers because they didn't want to add MLAG for obvious reasons, and I'm pretty sure I've read some blog posts of yours, and I think we agree on this, that MLAG is, it's kind of like what Churchill said about democracy. It's like, it's the worst form of government except for everything else. It's like MLAG is the worst protocol, but we don't have anything else, any other way to solve the problems we have in the data center right now, or no available ways.
Well, and so, we do, but people have to get creative.
Well, like for instance, and this is actually something you and I chatted on the Class C block a while back, was so like from VXLAN, for instance.
No, it's very simple, even in the VLAN space. If only people would forward based on IP addresses, not on MAC addresses. Very simple.
What I was saying was VXLAN. I don't know if you misheard me, but what I was talking about was for like VXLAN tunnels, because there's that level of abstraction with the VXLAN tunnel endpoints, it only accesses one IP address. So you either have to introduce layer 3 and a routing protocol at the vSwitch level, which to my knowledge hasn't been done yet, or you have to introduce multiple tunnel endpoints for a specific VXLAN tag, which doesn't exist either. And so you either have active-passive lag on your chassis or on your host, or you can have MLAG so you can get the full amount of bandwidth. And neither is...
Or, and this is what no one has done yet, or you have two host routes pointing to that host from two top-of-rack switches. Only you don't learn the host routes through a routing protocol. You learn them through DHCP or ARP snooping or what have you. I'm just saying, don't even use MAC addresses at all. Just route on IP addresses.
Well, let's go down that trail. Let's assume you have a completely isolated Fabric A and a completely isolated Fabric B, which is the Nirvana. The two top of rack switches aren't linked. You still cannot achieve that because, unless you can, and I'm just missing something.
Oh, you have to redistribute those host routes then into the routing protocol. So they have to go at least up to the spine level.
But the spines are isolated too. So how does it get from one Fabric A's spines to Fabric B's spines?
You have to have some cross connect somewhere.
Gotcha. A layer 3 cross connect.
Yeah.
Though. Yeah. Which that's fine. I'm okay with layer 3 cross connects.
Yeah. The idea is that, you know, like Microsoft is doing in Hyper-V, in MVGRE stuff, they're not looking at MAC addresses at all. When they get a VM packet, they look at the IP address they route.
Mm-hmm.
And we can do the same thing on the top of rack switches, only no one has done it. Anyway, back to your data center. So
yes,
you have your wired box switches, you have Cumulus on top of that, and you build the whole data center with Cumulus, right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Any problems?
It's a good question. No, we haven't. We aren't doing anything crazy, though. We don't have any corner cases. We aren't doing anything that's not kind of widely tested, I guess you should say. And so it's kind of like everything, right? Like, I never had a problem with a Cisco box until I tried to do some kind of corner case. And so the same applies here. We aren't trying to do any corner cases. We're doing readily available stuff. It's a leaf spine architecture, layer 3 fabric, no added bells and whistles. And no, we have not had a single problem. And now I will not say everything's been totally, you know, peachy. And I actually said this in my LinuxCon talk too. There's plenty of annoyances running in a shell and trying to configure everything through a shell. And I will say, in a little bit of Cumulus's defense, that's not how it's meant to be configured. However, if you don't have those abstractions built, that's how you have to configure them. So until those abstractions get built by our team or by, for instance, there's some Puppet and Chef things you can do on top of Cumulus. There's Ansible modules you can use on Cumulus. But until those abstractions are built or implemented, you have to configure them ad hoc. And configuring these devices ad hoc is not as easy as configuring a Cisco device ad hoc or an Arista device ad hoc, because there is no formal way of doing that. You're just dropped into the bash shell and it's like, okay, go find the config files you need to edit and then you're good. So from a stability perspective, there's been no problems. And that was one of the things that we weighed beforehand, right? So it was like, okay, we're getting this switch. And from a hardware perspective, I felt really good about it because, I mean, it's the same. Like, there's only a handful of companies in the industry that pump out the devices for everyone, right? So, like, you could go to a Quanta place, or you could go to an Acton place and you could see, you know, Cisco or Arista or Juniper or, you know, whomever's kit coming off of those lines. And then occasionally you'll see like an EdgeCore, which is Acton's kind of white box company. And so from a hardware perspective, I didn't really have any issues about that. Even though it's designed by different people, the same parts and assembly processes are the same. And so I didn't have any qualms about the hardware. The only issue I had, or the only kind of skepticism I had going into it, was the software side, the Cumulus side. And from that perspective, whenever I got dropped into a Cumulus box for the first time, when I first logged into it, I don't really know what I was expecting. I knew it was just they gave you access to Linux. But when I first logged in, I was like, whoa, they really just give you access to Linux. Like, it was almost surprising. Like, I knew that, but it was kind of a weird sensation to be logged into a 48-port switch and be in a bash shell. It was a weird experience.
So you knew what was going to happen, and it was still like, oh, shit.
Yeah, well, it wasn't really oh, shit, but it was more like, oh, I was expecting this, but I wasn't expecting this.
I haven't realized what it means.
Yeah, exactly. And so I was expecting it, but was still very surprised by it in both a good way and an almost intimidating way. Now, I knew enough about Linux to where it wasn't intimidating. It was intimidating, but I knew exactly what to do. Like, okay, I need to go here and do this, and I need to go here and do this. And Cumulus, by the way, has phenomenal documentation. And so from that perspective, it wasn't that bad. And I will say this, from day one when we were running Cumulus, we started out on Cumulus 1.5, and we're on what is it, like 2.2.1 right now, I think. I think it's 2.2. With ifupdown 2, it reduced our production config by like, I actually did the math, and I can't remember it off the top of my head. It was in my LinuxCon slide, but I think it was like 75%. So like ifupdown 2 is just a rewrite of, let me actually back up. So the way that every Linux distribution works is you need some way of interacting with the Linux kernel. And most distributions have a specific way of doing that. For instance, in Red Hat, on Red Hat or Fedora or CentOS, basically Red Hat-based distributions, they have the, I can't remember exactly what they call it, but it's like the network configuration services where you edit the like Etsy.
Something, yeah.
Yeah, scripts / interfaces or whatever. And then on Debian-based distributions, it's like Etsy network interfaces. And they all have like a corresponding process or application or binary that will read those files and transpose that into netlink calls. So it goes back to what we were talking about way earlier with everything's a netlink call. The same thing's true, obviously, in Debian and then therefore in Cumulus. And its process that reads the Etsy network interfaces file is called ifupdown. Well, Cumulus rewrote ifupdown and called it ifupdown 2, and is actually backporting that and pushing that towards Debian, which is awesome. But basically added a lot of sanity to Etsy network interfaces. So obviously ifupdown was created for managing a server that probably has at max
one interface.
You know, four interfaces. Yeah, four interfaces at max. And so managing a switch that has, you know, 50 interfaces out of the box, and then also you have to manage every sub interface as its own interface. You're talking about potentially hundreds and hundreds of interfaces on one box. And that it's not unfeasible, but it's not fun, and it's not something you want to troubleshoot on a live production switch if you've got hundreds and hundreds of interfaces that are configured in this one file. Like, I don't want to touch that. So ifupdown 2 has dramatically simplified that, and also including like loops where you can actually like do a for loop or a while loop, not a while loop, but like a for loop inside of the actual configuration file. So like, do this X for all of these interfaces, or do this Y for all these interfaces. But it's dramatically simplified it, as well as adding some other ways of being able to interact with ifupdown from the actual interface config file level, where it's dramatically simplified it. So I'm not saying it's perfect. However, from version 1.5 and just standard Debian, how you would interact with interfaces, to now, it's drastically different and drastically better.
Just to make this clear, so you have some config file where you define the interfaces.
Mm-hmm.
And then this daemon reads that config file and implements whatever is in that config file.
Correct.
And that happens during the boot process. What if you have
Correct.
What if you have to add an interface later on? How do you do that?
So there's a couple of different ways to do that. And so before ifupdown 2, you would have to like if down or if up an interface if you wanted to add an interface to do it where it didn't just like take your whole switch down. There's obviously IP route 2 that you can do it from a live config perspective. So like I want to add this link and I want to add these VLANs, and then you can use bridge control to add the those bridges or those interfaces into a bridge. However, with if up down 2, now you can just add that config statefully into that and then do like if up the bridge name, and it'll automatically go through and say, okay, well, it depends on these new interfaces that didn't exist before. So let me create those and let me turn them up, and okay, now let me add them to the bridge. And so that's what I mean by it's gotten drastically better.
But are these new interfaces, new connections to a bridge, for example, just in the runtime, or do they also get back into the config file that will be read at the next reload?
So yeah, so they're both. So you would, the way that I would do that today is I would go into a switch. I would open the Etsy network interfaces file. I would do whatever VLAN, like non-layer 3 stuff that I need to do. So like layer 1, layer 2 type stuff. I would make those config changes, and then I would exit that interfaces file, and then I would if up or if down if up the bridge. Or does that make sense? Like you can, and you don't actually have to if down it anymore. You can just say if up bridge name. It sees the differences and makes the correct.
It's like the changes. Reload.
Correct. Well, it's
properly implemented reload.
Correct. Exactly. So it reads the config file, sees the changes, and implements them via netlink calls to create the correct state.
But in traditional network gear terms, you are editing startup configuration with a text editor.
Correct. So you're using like Vim or Nano to get into this.
Yeah.
Right.
But you're effectively editing the startup configuration, and then you're telling...
Correct.
You're doing a config good analogy. Replace from startup config.
Yes, that's a better analogy. I was going to say it's like creating your config file and then committing it. But you're right. And in a real sense, that really is a better parallel. It's instead of replacing it, which it is kind of like that too. It's more like make your changes and then commit those changes almost. And you can choose at what level you want to commit them to. So you could say, you know, I want to create these 5 new bridges, but I only want to bring them up one at a time.
Okay. So you can have the configuration in the startup config file, sort of. And then you can say, well, now bring up this object, now bring up that object, now bring up that object.
Correct.
This is great if you want to do text editing or if you are willing to munch that file with a Perl script or whatever. But what if you need some right. API access?
All right. So I actually have a project that I've been working on. It's called Cumulus API, and it's a REST API, which all that means is, hey, I did over HTTP. So it's a REST API that it basically translates whatever you call into NetLink. And so, for instance, you can create VLANs or remove VLANs or create interfaces or like sub-interfaces and et cetera. And you can do that all through this API. And instead of like going through and like calling a shell command like, you know, IP route, it actually makes the netlink call to the kernel. So it's a very programmatic access. I can get very good state back from like, okay, this succeeded, this didn't, etc.
Which is, yeah, it's easier to get the correct response back than going through the command line interface and hoping that the exit status is okay.
Right, exactly. And so now it's very this project is very early on and it's in its kind of infancy, if you will. And the reason why is I kind of developed the things that I needed internally in our cloud environment, and then the rest of it's kind of created on like system boot almost. So like it's kind of like we have a config template that we put on a switch and it gets its base config, its IP address, etc. And then the rest of it, for the rest of the life cycle of that switch, it's just manipulating what VLANs are on a certain port, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so all we needed was, from a programmatic perspective, was to be able to provision those VLANs. And so that's all I've developed so far. But there's obviously a lot you can do with that. And so the kind of end goal is for it to be a fully functional API.
So you wrote your own web server.
Correct. And I utilize Flask.
A module for a web server.
Right.
That translates HTTP as requests into netlink calls.
Correct.
And currently, the only thing it can do, because that's what you need, are VLANs.
VLANs and sub-interface creation, which is a part of creating VLANs, et cetera. Yeah. And the kind of the way, so this was, I did all this work pre if up down 2. And so it also creates a file on the file system that's just a JSON file of the current state that you've configured everything to. And it will read that at boot as well and put all of that into the kernel. And so
that was my next question. How did you know it?
Well, probably because it was one of those deals that I had to accomplish as well, because obviously I couldn't just say, like, here's this state and see you next time you reboot. So yeah, it was, I save all of that state into a JSON file on the file system and then read that file on boot and make sure everything's in the correct state. So
perfect.
That's actually a good example of kind of the power of what you can do in Qmos, because obviously you can't accomplish what I just said on any other switch platform. I mean, maybe you can, but one of the things that's unique about Qmos is, like, a lot of people are giving you shell access now, right? So like Cisco's starting to do that on the Nexus 9K. Arista's been doing that. They give you shell access. But a lot of times it's not like a widely supported or even known distribution of Linux. A lot of times it's either, you know, custom compiled kernel or custom kind of distribution. So it's not like you can just throw like a Debian package or an RPM on there and run whatever application you want. You're at best going to be able to cross compile some binaries and throw them on there and hope they work, because you hope they have whatever libraries you need. One of the unique things, and one of the things that is a requirement for you to be able to use this as a development platform, is the fact that it's a widely supported distribution. And so because it's Debian based, and as they start or they finish their work on newer platforms that are x86, you can run whatever application you want to on it. You can use the existing Debian packages to run on these devices. And so being able to easily, like, for instance, one of the things, so all of the work that I did on the Qmos API is done in Python, and it requires several different libraries. Well, all of those libraries I could just install via Python pip, because I had access to that on this switch, which is like, name me another switch I can do that on. So a lot of vendors like to kind of tick that checkbox of, hey, we give you shell access. But a lot of times it's either a custom built distribution or it's not something that you have any kind of package access to. And so being Qmos being Debian based is actually really important to me, because a lot of the stuff that I did on the Qmos API required certain packages that I was able to just apt-get that I wouldn't be able to do on certain other platforms, which is another reason why I say it's kind of like the ultimate development platform, and why it's appealing to people with that kind of DevOps mentality or people who are writing their own code. And so for me, it's like it's really important that it's not only just, yeah, you have shell access, but it's you have shell access to a widely supported distribution that you can put packages on.
Yeah, so it means that you can just pull down whatever you wish from Debian repositories and start on top of that.
Yep. And so, like, out of the box, they have you don't have the actual normal Debian repositories for obvious reasons, because they can't support everything, but you can add them and you can get those packages. But for me, like, in the Qmos API, I was able to install, like, for instance, Python pip to get the things that I needed, and then use that package to get other, like, Python libraries that I needed to run the Python API or the Qmos API. And so a lot of those things kind of added up together to be like, okay, this is unique. This is not something I can do on another platform.
Okay. It's getting late, so let's wrap this up. The last question.
Okay.
Obviously, Qmos works for you because you are a cloud service provider and deeply technical and willing to go down as many rabbit holes as you need. Mm-hmm. What if you would be a typical enterprise customer?
So I actually got word for word this exact same question at LinuxCon.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Surprise. I got asked basically that word for word, and then also kind of, is it ready for production? Let me answer both of those. Really quickly, yes, it is ready for production. And then, is it ready for enterprise? That depends. That's always the answer, right? I would say it's not the perfect platform for your traditional shop that's like, okay, I have maybe 4, 5, 10 racks. I've got people who basically manage applications, and I have a managed service provider that comes puts the stuff in for me. But let me disclaim that with, Qmos as is not ready for that. And that's, again, going back to that development platform. I think there's a myriad of opportunities for even a managed service provider to come in and say, we're going to give you Qmos as your top of rack, and we're going to give you this pane of glass to manage it with. And so I think kind of going back to what we were saying earlier, the pain points really do center around the management plane. And when I say pain points, I guess I mean the where the innovation can happen. And so they've given you a platform to where you can build the most elaborate management plane that you could ever imagine. And they give you the simplest one to start. And so to answer your question, it's yes, it's ready for prime time. It's not for everybody. However, I can definitely see it as a platform by which people can value add on top of it. And then I would be able to answer your question with yes, with this package or this package, it is ready for an enterprise.
Perfect. Thank you. So thanks for all the insight into Cumulus Linux. If people want to know more about what you're doing with those boxes or want to contact you, how can they get to you?
For sure. My Twitter handle is @BigMStone. I can be found there pretty much all the time. And then I blog at MatthewStone.net, which was formerly BigMStone.com, and I'm changing that back over. So I blog there rarely, but I'm actually going to try and pick up some of that stuff as I think you can thank Network Field Day. I'm kind of getting interested in more computer science-y things like machine learning and stuff. So hopefully I'll be able to post some kind of brainy stuff on that, or maybe I'll just look like an idiot at the end of the day. Who knows?
No, you won't. Don't worry about that. So thanks for being with me. And for those of you who just stumbled on this podcast, I'm Ivan Pepelniak. I'm usually creating webinars, writing, blogging, doing whatever at ipspace.net, and occasionally tweeting as @iOSHints. If you want to know more about SDN in general, do go to ipspace.net/SDN, where you'll find links to loads of resources, effectively everything you need to get your SDN project off the ground. Links to books, podcasts, webinars, workshops, on-site workshops, and even consulting services. Finally, if you like the show, do tell a friend. Please leave a review on iTunes. You're not doing your job. We still don't have enough reviews to get an average that would be displayed in iTunes. And follow us at podcast.ipspace.net, where you'll also find all the links that we mentioned in today's podcast.